The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Elaine Weiss. Her book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote, has just come out in a paperback. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Vic.
I was amazed at how much I learned from this story. I had heard of some of the key figures, but I had no clue about any of this. What made you decide to write this?
Well, for the same reason as you, I had no clue. I realized I'm a voter. My parents taught me it was important to vote in every election, and I do, and I'm politically active. And yet I realized that I had no idea how it came that women got the vote after almost 150 years after the American experiment began. And I asked my friends, do you know how it happened? And they all kind of shrugged and said, no, not really. There's something like Seneca Falls, right?
Hmm.
And I realized that none of us know. It's not taught in school very much. And even if it is, it's usually one line that says something like, and in 1920, women were given the vote. And that's just not how it was. So I came across a story of the last battle for women's suffrage, which happened in Nashville, Tennessee, in the summer of 1920. And so this is the final battle to get the last state needed for ratification of the 19th Amendment, which would give the vote to all women in every state in every election. And they just need one more. They have 35. They need 36. And it looks like Tennessee is the last best hope for this. And so this enormous confrontation takes place between all the forces for suffrage and those opposed to it, all the different varieties of anti-suffrage activists and suffrage activists. And they all encamp in Nashville, Tennessee, in 1920, and they just, you know, have a battle royal, and it's very dramatic. But it also allowed me to step back and tell the story of how they got there and why they got there and how the movement evolved coming out of the abolition movement. What were the themes? What were the arguments against it? How hard it was. By this time, the women had been fighting for the vote for 72 years, three generations had been involved in this. They'd been engaged in over 900 campaigns on the national, state, or local level. And this becomes the pivotal turning point, the flashpoint for them. And it's all or nothing. And so it's a very dramatic story. But through that, I wanted to inform my fellow Americans, this is how it was. Our democracy continues to need to be expanded, and this is what was the largest expansion of our democracy in our history, and yet we don't know about it at all, how hard it was, and how similar it is to situations and political arguments that we're having today.
As you open the book, we are informed that three women are on their way to Nashville. And we learn a lot about these three women and about a lot of other people who are involved in the process. And it's fascinating to me to learn something that I think you were alluding to a moment ago, the way that the battle for suffrage was woven into the problem with racism. And how this right to vote is still very much tied in with racism. Can you explain the connections? This is really amazing.
Yeah. That was something that I learned through my research, how deeply entwined both rights for women and rights for African Americans have been throughout our history. So it begins, the women we know as the foremothers of the suffrage movement, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and Lucy Stone, Lucretia Mott, all of these women are actually begin their careers as abolition workers. They're going out into the countryside, they're making speeches, they're organizing to free the slaves. It was very dangerous work. They were threatened. They were mobbed. The meeting halls they were meeting in were set afire. It was very violent. And they're working with their allies, including Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison. And the idea is that all Americans, all citizens, deserve the vote. And once the black men and women can be freed, then all those groups that do not have the right to vote will have universal suffrage. Everybody will get the vote. And so through the Civil War, the women are working towards Emancipation Proclamation. This is part of their whole political philosophy. And they are bitterly disappointed when after the Civil War, after they've spent 25 years of their lives fighting for the rights of the African-American community, that they are left out of the 14th and 15th Amendment, which gives the right to vote to black men. And so there's a split there because the women feel betrayed, and they were betrayed. And yet Frederick Douglass says to them, look, we need the vote more for our very lives because there's great violence during Reconstruction. And the women's hour has not rung yet, but the women's hour will come. And that's where the title of my book comes from. And there is a split because there were some suffragists who worked against the 14th and 15th Amendment if women were not going to be included. And then you see this play out. The movements heal much of that rift, but not all. And there's certainly racism in the movement because it involves millions of women and men. But it also, there were very important and energetic black women suffragists who are working for the cause, as they called it. But one of the ways the anti-suffragists were trying to bludgeon the suffragists and trying to convince Americans that this was not a good idea was using racial animosity. It's there that you see these terrible statements because they do not want black women to vote. Now, black men have had the vote in 1920 since 1870 with the 15th Amendment, but of course it's been not properly enforced, and Jim Crow laws have deprived black men in the South of the vote. And so the idea that black women will now be given the vote is very frightening to some of the Southern states. And that's what you see play out in Tennessee. You see the Confederate flag being waved in Tennessee. There's lots of statements about the Civil War and about the Southern way of life, and it's all code for racism and for white supremacy. You see the Ku Klux Klan being invoked. And so you see this very vicious racial cudgel being used against the idea of all women voting. So, race is entwined throughout the whole movement. And, of course, today we see that places where voter suppression is most intense and most egregious is in minority communities. So we're still fighting that battle. We're still fighting to preserve our democracy and preserve voting rights. And I think that's where my story comes into the present, that these arguments are still being used. And it's our responsibility to really protect the vote for now for all citizens. So that racial aspect is both a fascinating, troubling, and perhaps we can learn lessons from it.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, in our world. Since 1958, it's the Book Nook. My guest is Elaine Weiss. Her book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote, just out in paperback. And 1920 was the year of the election between two Ohio candidates, Warren Harding from Marion, Ohio, and James Cox from Dayton, Ohio. And these candidates are very much a part of the story. So is the sitting president, Woodrow Wilson, a very incapacitated Woodrow Wilson, who, along the course of the story, has burned in effigy, and some women are sent to jail for this. This is fascinating to read.
Yeah, Ohio plays a very large role in the book. As you say, both presidential candidates in 1920 are from Ohio. And so the suffragists shuttle back and forth from Nashville and from Washington to lobby them. There's a demonstration on the front lawn of Warren Harding's house in Marion. I describe that in great detail. It's an amazing, there was something called like the notification day, where the candidate would be notified by his party. And this was, think of it as like the 4th of July and homecoming. And you have bands and floats, and just goes on for hours, and huge picnics. And this takes place in Marion. And then there's another one in Dayton for Governor Cox. And Governor Cox's running mate is a young, ambitious politician named Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And so he enters the story, too. And, of course, Ohio was a very energetic suffrage state. And you have women like Harriet Taylor Upton, who is a national leader of the suffrage movement and a leader of the Ohio suffragists. So you have a lot of activity coming out of Ohio that figures into the story a great deal.
My guest is Elaine Weiss, and Elaine is going out on book tour for the publication of the paperback, and she will be coming through Dayton. There's an event taking place brought to you by the League of Women Voters, The Dangerous Dames of Dayton, Friday, March 22nd at 6 p.m. at the NCR Country Club. Elaine will be speaking and signing copies of the book. And this is a ticketed event in Kettering at the NCR Country Club. So for information, you need to contact the League of Women Voters of Dayton to find out about coming out to see The Dangerous Dames of Dayton and their keynote speaker, Elaine Weiss. I imagine you're looking forward to that.
Oh, greatly. I think speaking to the League is extra special for me, because my story is the origin story of the League of Women Voters. And bringing that to leagues around the country has been a great pleasure, because some members don't even realize that the suffrage leader, one of the main characters in my book, Carrie Chapman Catt, as soon as women are given the vote, she invents the League of Women Voters as an educational organization to help women understand how to look at the issues, how to be good citizens, how to be an informed voter. And that's still their mission, and it's still what they're doing today. So it's very much a daughter of the suffrage movement and celebrating its 100th birthday. So it's really very exciting to bring this story to the women who are been bringing it forward, who have taken on the mantle of educating the public about citizenship and about how important it is to vote.
Carrie Catt is one of the women who's headed to Nashville at the beginning. She's one of the main characters, one of the main figures in this. And another one who I had never heard of, but I was absolutely fascinated by her, is Josephine Pearson. Tell us about her.
Yes, Josephine Pearson is the leader of the Tennessee Anti-Suffrage Organization, the women opposed to suffrage. And she is a very interesting character. She is very highly educated. She's actually probably the best educated of all the women I profile in the book. She is a college professor and college dean. She is a student of political science, and yet she also is very politically and religiously conservative. And her mother was against the idea of women's suffrage because, again, she thought women's place was in the home, and this would be disruptive to the American home. She also thought it wasn't God's plan to give women the vote, and also fears that it will change, as she calls it, the Southern way of life, which means white supremacy in the South. So she promises her mother in a very touching deathbed scene that she will fight women's suffrage if it ever comes to Tennessee. So she enters the movement as an opponent, and she finds her voice. It's ironic. She finds her voice in opposing women speaking out and taking a political role. So here she is taking a political role, but it's all in the cause of keeping other women from taking a political role. So that kind of ironic aspect becomes clear. But she's a fascinating figure because she believes deeply that this is wrong. This giving women the vote is wrong. It's bad for her state. It's bad for women themselves. And so her arguments are very interesting to us because there's still modern reflections of it today used to counter certain social reforms. Marriage equality, we saw many of these same arguments used for that. And so it seems kind of quaint that she would be saying these things. Oh, my God, this seems so far-fetched. And then you think about it and you say, wait a second, I heard these arguments in my lifetime. They're still being used. Mm. So I think by looking at the anti-suffragists, both Josephine Pearson and her colleagues from New York and Washington who come down, the anti-suffrage leaders come down to assist her, and you hear their arguments. You hear their denouncement of the suffragists as perverts, as anarchists, as Bolsheviks, as unsexed women, and you realize how brutal this campaign was. It was not ladylike. It was not pretty. And Josephine Pearson is in the middle of it.
It gave me flashbacks to the Equal Rights Amendment and the Eagle Forum and Phyllis Schlafly. It just all seemed so familiar, yet I hadn't heard about it. And you talk about the irony of Josephine speaking out. And you also talk about how her dear mother had wanted her to do that. And then we have another dear mother whose son was in the Tennessee legislature, a guy named Harry Byrne. You need to read to the end of the book to find out what his mother wanted him to do. Just fascinating. And another thing that struck me, having watched our current president's most recent State of the Union address, where he warned about the dangers of socialism, and here they were waving that flag 100 years ago, weren't they? And further back than that.
Oh, yeah. It was, again, one of those fascinating shock of recognition when you realize that the anti-suffrage groups were accusing the suffragists of being secretly Bolshevik or communist. And there were pamphlets that were distributed called the Red Behind the Yellow Skirts. Yellow was the suffrage color. So they're saying that red behind the whole movement, and that this was, and of course the Russian Revolution had just happened in 1917. So it's all very fresh and frightening. So this idea that any group of women agitating for this kind of reform is dangerous and so becomes part of a communist plot to upend our society is actually something that the anti-suffragists don't give up, even after ratification of the 19th Amendment. In my afterword, I talk about how they the anti-suffragists have learned to organize, and they've learned they have power. And so in some ways, they get stronger after the passage of the 19th Amendment, where the suffragists kind of go home and tend to their own interests. Carrie Catt forms the League of Women Voters. Alice Paul, the leader of the National Women's Party, the more radical strain of the American suffrage movement, drafts the Equal Rights Amendment, which he has introduced in 1923 into Congress, and spends the rest of her life campaigning for that. But the anti-suffragists become anti-communists. So you see them going after Carrie Catt and Jane Addams and other prominent suffragists years later and calling them communists. And then you see them in the McCarthy era. And then you see them, that those same conservative groups train Phyllis Schlafly. So there's this maternal line that is so fascinating of conservative women finding their voice in the suffrage movement.
The more things change, the more they stay
and
the
same. And, of course, at the State of the Union, while the flag of socialism was being denounced, you also had the display of those dozens of congresswomen wearing white in honor of the suffragists. Mm-hmm. That's what they were doing. That was to honor the legacy of the suffragists.
That was very powerful. And especially the strange way that President Trump gave them, paid tribute to them, and it was just, the whole thing was bizarre.
I'm not quite sure he grasp the whole situation there.
Yeah. My guest is Elaine Weiss. We're talking about her book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. And as I mentioned a moment ago, she's coming through Dayton on book tour. There's an event at the NCR Country Club, 4435 Dogwood Trail in Kettering. This is at 6 p.m. on Friday, March 22nd. The League of Women Voters is bringing Elaine in for their Dangerous Dames of Dayton. She's going to be speaking. And this is a ticketed event, and for information, you'll need to contact the League of Women Voters to find out more about that. Friday, March 22nd, from 6 until 9 o'clock that evening, the NCR Country Club in Kettering. And I think the bottom line in this, in my mind, mostly southern states were opposed. Their legislatures voted down the possibility of approving the suffrage. And with the exception of Delaware, I think most of them were in the South. And the bottom line in my mind was they did not want black women to be able to vote because they wanted to stay in power. And they saw those votes as being definitive as far as knocking them out of power.
Oh, yes. That's absolutely very true. And in the South, it also had a cultural and social element that if black women had political equality, they might aspire to social equality. And that becomes an issue. Mm. I also think that while the South was the sort of most opposed to suffrage, not all the states, Texas and Arkansas actually do ratify, as I won't give away the ending, but a certain other state does ratify in the end. But it was very close in places like New Jersey. It was not a slam dunk in any way. And in fact, in Ohio, there was a move to rescind or to challenge Ohio's ratification. So it was not simple. It was very politically fraught and politically complicated. And you had lawyers on every side. Everyone had lawyered up. And they were fighting each other in the courts. Even after a state ratified, anti-suffragists, if it had been approved, would run into court and say, oh, no, it's unconstitutional. And in fact, even in my state of Maryland, which rejected the 19th Amendment, did not ratify, there were groups of lawyers who sued to say that the 19th Amendment went against state law, the state constitution, which said only white men could vote. And they said, this goes against state law. And they bring that suit to the Supreme Court. This is after ratification. This is 1922. And finally, the Supreme Court denies their suit. But it really was challenged for a long, long time, including in Ohio.
Speaking of Ohio, back in high school, my American history teacher told us about how Warren Harding had had an affair with Nan Britton, and she ended up publishing a book called The President's Daughter, and he was engulfed in scandals of various types, corruption, a wandering eye got him in trouble, and you filled that in a little bit. I didn't realize he was paying all this money to bribe people, and it's just intriguing to read this. I was so gratified that you included that.
Yeah, because it actually does enter into the story. I don't do it just for salacious purposes. But he is, he's being blackmailed by at least two of his mistresses. He's paying money to one of them who is blackmailing him and saying, I will go public. I will sell, in fact, she threatens to sell her story to a tabloid.
Huh.
Again, I wrote this book before the 2016 election and before...
Right.
Certain revelations have come to us, and he is paying, or the RNC, actually, the Republican National Committee, is paying for one of his mistresses. He had quite a few. She and her husband, they send them to Japan on a cruise, like go to the other side of the world and don't come back for a year, so that they're totally cut off from the press. So that's going on. Meanwhile, he is not being supportive or forthcoming to the suffragists. Hmm. So he's playing this game where he says, oh, I support all women, but he's really not doing what he promises to do. And he really almost undermines the whole ratification campaign. And yet he is paying hush money to keep his affairs quiet so that he can win the presidency. And the irony is that Harding wins in a landslide, and it's the women's vote in 1920, those women who have now been enfranchised, that puts him over the top. What does that tell you?
It's fascinating.
But, of course, they didn't know about the hush money. They didn't know about his affairs. The press was a little more restrained then, and so that was not public knowledge.
They were restrained right up through JFK, and it's fascinating to me to see here on the cover of the New York Times front page today, there's a copy of a canceled check to Michael D. Cohen, $35,000, signed by Donald J. Trump from his personal account. The more things change.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you'll see, I quote Warren Harding's letters to his mistress saying, well, how about $5,000 a month? And, and he's setting out the terms.
That was a lot of money back then, too.
Yes. Yes, wow. It was. And they give her a lump sum. And then there's he has a baby out of wedlock, too. And he is paying to keep the mother and baby quiet.
Wow.
So, yeah. And all of that since has been proven by DNA evidence. And then his love letters to the mistress who is blackmailing him were in the Ohio Historical Society under lock and key.
Been a pleasure talking to you about your book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to coming to Dayton.
The book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Elaine Weiss wrote it. She's been my guest today, and she'll be in town March 22nd. Contact the League of Women Voters for information. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis.